History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a gentleman who's about to turn 93, but went through quite an experience as a teenager during World War II. Jerry Deitch is our guest today. Been in Las Vegas for the last quarter century. He still is a volunteer with the police department here. We'll talk about that. But let's go way back, Jerry, to Brooklyn, New York, as a child. What are those earliest memories you have of the Big Apple in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I have a lot of memories because it was a time that depression was started. And we had very little. What we did have a lot of was food. And reason for that is my father was a master chef. And in lieu of pay, he got mostly good steaks and very good food. So we never lacked food. As a matter of fact, I used to have friends and neighbors come in. My father, but it got a half a salary, half in food and half in very little salary. But that was the times. Nobody had anything. So I wasn't jealous of anybody. Everybody around me didn't have anything.
And you were one of four children growing up in that family in Brooklyn. You mentioned your father being a master chef. Where was he a chef? Was it a restaurant
was,
there?
He was in a restaurant. At one time he was in Waldorf Astoria. In the banquet room he was a chef there. But most of all he was one of the first union members. And wherever there was an opening at a restaurant, he got in there. The most I remember was one particular restaurant. He was there about 10 years, and he got half salary and the other half in food. I like the other half in food.
Yeah, it came in real handy during the Great Depression, I'm sure. And I know at this age, you would have never heard of a Navy SEAL. No one had. They didn't exist yet. But you would be part of the predecessors to the SEALs eventually. I'm wondering when you were that boy, and you had an older brother and an older sister and a little brother, what were the things you dreamt about that you said, hey, when I grow up, here's what Jerry's going to do?
You know, when I was a little boy and I was a reader, and I said I would like to be an engineer and like to make drafts of big skyscrapers. And I used to dream about that. Mm-hmm. I said, one day I have to be an engineer. And that, of course, disappeared. When I joined the military, I had thoughts of making that my career, a military. Then I was hurt and had the headache problem, which I had for a long time. A lot of good memories and a lot of bad memories. The bad memories of guys that I worked with for, you know, so many months that just didn't make it. And that sort of stayed with me a long time. I never spoke to my family about experiences because I for a couple of years after I got out of the military, I had nightmares. I don't think a year went by where I didn't have half a dozen nightmares. But I spoke to a doctor about it, and he says, that's the usual thing. You know, it's going to happen. Eventually, it'll disappear. I'll tell you, it never disappears every June 6th. I still have nightmares.
We're going to talk about June 6th. And this June 6th, on the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, you're going to be part of a very special ceremony. We'll talk about that, too. But while I'm thinking about you as that boy growing up in Brooklyn, I'm just wondering, maybe it's just me, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm into baseball, and I think being a kid in New York in the 30s had to be the best for a baseball fan.
I was a Yankee fan. I was a diehard Yankee fan, and when I went into the service, I became a Brooklyn Dodger fan, but I still got the Yankees at heart.
Well, and then you had the Yankees, you had the Dodgers, you had the Giants right there in New York City.
Yeah, I had the Giants in football, but I didn't. They were my enemies in baseball.
And were you ever at the house that Ruth built, watching him play?
I went there. I never watched him play, no. Mm-hmm. Saw photos of him, news reports of him, that's it.
Listen to the games on the radio?
Always, always. And my son says to me, did you enjoy it listening to the radio? I said, the same as if I was there. You just, your mind works differently. You just hear it and you think you're there.
So you're growing up and December 7th, 1941. Seems like everybody who was alive remembers something about that day.
I know exactly what I was doing. I was listening to, at that time, the Brooklyn Dodgers had a football team and the New York Giants before the National Football League came in. And I was listening to the game and they interrupted the game and said Pearl Harbor was attacked. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was or what Pearl Harbor was, but I knew that we were attacked. That was it. The next day, I was on the fencing team in high school and I watched the basketball team, the seniors, all left school and went to volunteer. And that's when it really hit me.
And you were too young to go in then, but did it cross your mind?
I was 15 years old, and I'll tell you a story. I went with the basketball team to volunteer, and they said hello and goodbye.
You couldn't pass for old enough, huh?
Oh, I was 15 and probably looked like I was 13.
Well, and even younger than that, there was a significant moment in your life. When you were 11, you met someone special and you told her that you thought you two should get married. Do I have that straight?
Yeah, you have that straight. I didn't tell her. I told it to her mother.
Well, we've got to hear that story. How did you two first meet?
Well, I became a Boy Scout when I was 11 years old, and I met her cousin who lived next door to her, and we became good buddies. He invited me over to his house one time, and that's how I met my wife, Selma. And I knew right away. She didn't. We were just friends. But I became so close to her family. She was the only child, but I called her mother Aunt Minnie, and she referred to me as nephew. And then I said one day after a couple of months of knowing her, I says, I'm going to marry your daughter one day. And she said, and when would that be? And I hardly remember that, but she always brought it up to me. I said, when I'm 40 years old.
Well, you didn't wait that long, did you?
No, when I was 20 years old, I was in on leave, and I said to her, will you marry me? She said, let me think about it. And then I went over to her mother, and she said, it's up to Selma. And she finally came around to it about 3 months later.
And meanwhile, all these other things are going on. So you say, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, you tried to sign up then. You weren't old enough yet. As you got closer and closer to 18, and you thought about the prospect of the draft and the government deciding where you were going to go in this war effort, what was the decision you ended up making?
Well, I knew one sure I didn't want to go into the Army. I wanted to go into the Navy, but I wasn't the best kind of sailor. I got seasick on rowboats or on a ferry. So I went ahead, and I heard about Special Forces, and I volunteered for that, but I had to take some hard exams, and I aced them all, and they took me in after 5 weeks. I finished boot camp early, and 3 weeks later, a week after my 18th birthday, I was on the Queen Mary on my way to Scotland. And 4 days later, I was in Scotland.
How did your parents feel about your decision to do that and what you volunteered for?
Well, they weren't too happy because my older brother was already drafted. He was in, and they said, can't you wait a while? And I said, no, because now I have the chance to pick out the service that I want. Otherwise, they're going to choose what they think is the proper thing for me. And they finally, well, my father acquiesced. My mother wasn't too happy.
And you said something there, you know, that you volunteered for Special Forces. Now, I've had so many veterans over the years, hundreds of them tell me the first rule of the military is you never volunteer for anything.
I promised my older brother when I said, speak to Mom and Dad. And I wrote him letters because he's already overseas. And I said, speak to Mom and Dad and tell them to let me go into the service. He says, Jerry, make one promise to me that you'll never volunteer. And I said, word of honor, we'll never volunteer. When they called for volunteers, I was the first one to raise my hand.
And did you have any idea what you were volunteering for?
Absolutely not. I knew that the Seabees were involved because they were training us in demolitions. And I always thought of construction, that's going to be my thing. I'm going to be an engineer. So I thought very little of it. I just the fact that they were Seabees, construction battalion, I went in. I did not know anything about it.
If you had known then what you know now, do you think you would have volunteered?
Absolutely. It became in my blood very fast.
Well, and you became part of something that's called an NCDU, and a lot of people maybe have never heard of that.
Naval Combat Demolition Unit was something new. You work with engineers, Army engineers. They were much older than us because they were Seabees. So they went in prior to the war. So we trained with them on all kinds of explosives and reconnaissance work. Most of them were old enough to be my father.
When you say you train with explosives and reconnaissance work, when I think of training with explosives, sounds kind of dangerous. I mean, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. Sometimes you learn the lesson by blowing off an extremity or losing your life.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, we got great, great, great training. And any time that we were going to let explosives go, we yelled down the line, "Fire in the hole, fire in the hole." And that went right down the line. Everybody jumped out of the way. We were trained safety first. Look around before you let an explosive go. Before you pull the pin, make sure you haven't anybody. And we worked in two buddies, two men at a time. Make sure you covered him and he covered you.
And you gave us a sense of how quickly you were rushed into action after you volunteered and how quickly you headed overseas. You mentioned you turned 18 in April of 1944, a couple months before the Normandy invasion. How much did you know ahead of time about what you guys were going to be doing?
Well, we trained for it. We did train for it. We trained in England, and we trained constantly. We trained day and night. We trained how the landing's going to take place. We knew everything, except where we were going. We had no idea where we were going. Then we went to a marshalling area, which was 48 hours before we boarded ships to go.
Well, and I'm just thinking back something you said. You said when you went into the Navy, you realized that you could get seasick on a rowboat and that you needed to do something other than be a sailor. So what about that journey across the Atlantic? Did you get seasick there?
Nobody got seasick on the Queen. Yeah, a couple of people did on the Queen Mary, but that was such a great ship. As a matter of fact, I got a simple story that I tell my family. I was sitting on a promenade deck, and there was a Protestant minister sitting right next to me, and he introduced himself to me, and I gave him my name, and he said, "Do you realize that when this ship was civilian ship, to be on a promenade deck, it would cost you a year's salary, and here you are sitting here on a promenade deck." I got to tell you, it was 5 days of, I will say one thing, because of so many troops on there, I ate at 6 o'clock in the morning breakfast and at 3 o'clock dinner. And I got to tell you, 8 o'clock at night, I was starving.
Yeah,
well, they couldn't feed everybody. You know, they had to do it. They had to do it that way. But it was 5 days. The ship was fast. They didn't have to zigzag. They just went straight across 4.5 days, New York to Scotland.
What about that time before the invasion? Are there some memories that stand out for you? Because you're a long way from home. I mean, and the United Kingdom is a big difference from New York City. Are there some things that happened or some things that stand out in your memories?
Yeah, I got to tell you that when we started the invasion, we went in on the first wave, I was sure that I was not going to see my family again. I saw bodies floating all around me, and you're oblivious of it. You really, maybe because you say, "Thank God it's not me," but you don't, you just look right past it. It didn't, it was never happening. Was I in shock? I possibly was. Possibly was, and I think everybody else was.
Well, and let me rewind just a little bit to when you said that, you know, 48 hours ahead of time, you find out this is happening now. You probably have no idea how big this is going to be, how many other people are involved. But what did you understand your mission or assignment or role to be before you went across the channel?
We knew right away that we were going to go in first. And if there were any obstacles that would be in the way of the first wave coming in behind us, that we would take care of that. We would make room for them to land. And in most cases, they couldn't. They stopped their boats in about 4 feet of water. Many of them may have drowned because they had all the gear on them, and they may have drowned because they couldn't. They just couldn't get ashore.
So a few questions come to mind just to try to fill in the blanks for people listening here. This is NCDU 30, Naval Combat Demolition Unit 30. You guys had 100 men in that unit?
I don't recall whether it was 50 at Utah Beach and 50 at Omaha Beach, or was it 100 and 100? It seems to me 50 and 50. But Omaha Beach was tough. They ran against cliffs, and the Germans were above, just throwing everything at them down the cliffs. They really took a beating.
Jerry's thankfully came ashore at Utah Beach, not Omaha Beach. But where he was wasn't exactly safe either, and he would learn that firsthand. When I first met Jerry Deitch in Las Vegas, he told me that on June 6th, 1944, 8 hours felt like 28 hours. Find out why when we come back. And for photos and video related to Jerry's story, head over to the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or to hometownheroesradio.com. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.